life experience in the epilogue. Wow, that's cool. I did not know that. I have a feeling, I mean, I've seen, there's been like professional artwork done, you know, in kind of depicting the scene. All right, but so Butters, former naval aviator yourself. So how many things did I say wrong just in that whole?
I didn't really catch anything wrong. That's a pretty remarkable story.
It is. I mean you've done tailhook landings before, so yeah, that stout piece of steel was never designed to do that though, was it?
No, it's good thinking on your feet. You know what that kind of brought me up to the modern. I was just looking up, trying to find the ranks of the crew on that the C-17 coming out of Afghanistan that piled in with the, you know, whatever, 640 Afghans or whatever. But just kind of bringing home the point that, like, those guys still exist. They're still in the cockpits because, yeah, you know, you talk about things that you're not trained for. I mean, those C-17 guys, they don't train to deal with what they dealt with in Kabul.
Yeah, that was a way over capacity load of refugees getting out.
And you don't ring the general and, hey, what do I do, sir? Like, you make a decision and you go with it. And
listen, man, C-17, I flew into Bagram on a C-17 one time, and I was coming in, just me. I got picked up somewhere else. I was being brought in, and I'll never forget. Loadmaster comes back. He looks at me, goes, "Hey, sir, we're making a combat land, coming in a 10,000-foot spiral. Just when I tell you, hang on, hang on." And I was like, "Okay, 10,000 feet spiral. I know you know what I'm talking about, but I had never seen or experienced this. That was better than an e-ticket at Disney World, man. He started at 10. He goes, "All right, sir, 10 seconds. Hang on." And next thing I know, the G is coming down. I couldn't sit up straight. It was pulling me down sideways in my seat.
Yeah, the first time I got to do that, I was in the back with all of our maintainers from our squadron flying into Bagram, and everybody threw their hands up in the air and
whoop, whoop,
and enjoyed it. So, yeah, that was a fun one.
Good times. And let me ask you this. So at aviation, whatever flight school or aviation school you went to, do they teach stuff like this Pardo's push, or do they try to avoid talking about that because they don't want to create recklessness? What's the scoop?
I mean, I think it's more, you know, we've kind of a rule of aviation is in an emergency, if you can stand before the man and answer for what you did,
yeah,
if you can justify your decisions, all the rules, all the, I mean, like, literally, that's what you see published. Like, hey, everything goes out the book. You know, now it becomes, what do you got to do to get back safely on the ground?
Yeah.
And so
there you go.
You know, it's just, it's good culture.
It's a great culture. And the no man left behind thing was a huge deal. I mean, he had every opportunity to just basically circle the area and see if they got under canopy when they ejected and got down to the ground. But he didn't. He decided to get them to a place where they could be rescued too, and put himself at risk by doing it.
Oh yeah.
I did see too in one of the articles I read when I studied up to write that one. Bob Pardo, like I said, he passed away last week, 89 years old. But he maintained contact with the guy, the pilot of the. You know, of course, it's a 2-man crew, but he maintained contact with him. Eamon was the wingman's name, and he found out that late in life that Eamon was diagnosed with Lou Gehrig's disease. And he raised the money to get him a handicapped accessible van. Continuing to do stuff for each other along the way, you know?
They're
very cool.
There are some epic stories from those Vietnam guys.
Yeah, there are. John from Huntsville, Texas, says, "Phil, fantastic monologue, very inspirational. Also, I'm glad to hear you say no man left behind, because I'm pretty sure that today's leftist media would probably prefer if you just said no person left behind." Right. There you go, brother. Say it the right way. Raven for Russellville, "Colonel, your monologue brought back lots of memories and a few tears." There you go. He says, "We never left anyone behind, and I have the scars to prove it. God bless you." Raven, thank you again, as always, for your service, brother. Not forgotten. Welcome home. And I tell you what, keep it in mind. Text lines are there for you, 833-687-4448. That's 833-68-RIGHT. In a minute, we're going to kick in with some stuff that's going to be coming up in Montgomery, or not coming up in Montgomery, or how are they going to do this, or is it ever going to happen? So I'm calling this section the same old legislative story, but it's not always what you expect. Sometimes it's the bills like, are they really going to be able to mandate that they play the national anthem every single day in schools? I just don't know. But the bill's coming back up for about the umpteenth time. And then what's going to happen with things like school choice? And are they really going to go for Medicaid expansion? Phil, why do we care? Because it costs so much money. But it'll help people. Will it really? Or does it create more entitlement? It's a debate that we have every single year. Democrats never get tired of it. The question is, are we seeing some weak-kneed Republicans beginning to grasp hold of it? Hospital Association wants it badly. So, yeah, we're going to cover all those issues as part of same old legislative story. And again, at the same time, call it in, text it in, tell us what your thoughts are. It's a Friday afternoon, and so, yeah, I'm digging it. Friday. Friday, spelled literally F-R-I-Y-A-Y. But, all right. Stephanie Smith calling up top of the hour. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We'll be right back. All you Right Side ruffians out there, you are listening to Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right. And we are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. Just, I mean, like covering down on some major ground across the northern half of the most beautiful state in the nation. This one right here. I'm talking about Alabama. Y'all, we cover this show all the way down south of Birmingham and up north of Huntsville and Tuscaloosa, back to Gadsden, parts of Georgia, Tennessee, and even Mississippi. All thrown in just for good measure. All right, so, the same old legislative story. It's amazing to me. I mean, 8 years down there, I can just tell you, there are some things that come up and they go back, and they come up and they go back, and they come up and they never see the light of day, but they're going to bring them back again as a matter of principle or I don't know. Other things you look at and go, why can't we get that passed? Why does that take so long? What are we doing here? And then there's the really bad bills, like, you know, the gambling bills that are just like what we call zombie legislation. They never die. They keep coming back. Well, so these same old legislative stories, you look at them and go, And then there's also what I would call the themes. The people that have no clue what it means to consider, the Constitution, or they consider something else to be a right, which is not an actual right, or they run a bill that is designed to discriminate, and you think, that's probably not going to be a good idea. So So I pulled this off of a summary of bills that have already been pre-filed, right? So pre-filing means when you have that legislative session starting, throughout the session and up to a certain point when there's a cutoff, you can do what we used to call it dropping in a bill. So you have a piece of legislation. It's a 20-page thing about how to revise the probate code or who knows. And you have your bill, you get other sponsors on it if you want to, or you can just have it by yourself, but you have to do what's called dropping it in, which means it is given to the clerk of the Senate or clerk of the House, and they then read it into the record, and then they assign it to a committee, and then it moves the committee process, and yada, yada. Well, you can also do what's called pre-filing. A lot of folks will do things like they'll try to get their bill as, because it sounds kind of cool, when you come into the legislative session, and your bill is listed as Senate Bill 1, all right? Must be important, it's Senate Bill 1. No, it was just to name a road after somebody in a town, you know. Senate Bill 1! Anyway, but some of them are cool, and some of them are like, I don't know. So Senator Gerald Allen, who I consider to be a friend, he's got a bill that would mandate the Star-Spangled Banner in public schools. It is Senate Bill 2. It's been pre-filed already. It's already in there, it's in the queue, it's waiting. And I'll just be honest with you, I just don't know that we're ever going to see this really happen. And I say that because I think it's important. I don't have any problem at all with, you know, playing the Star Spangled Banner in schools. But I just don't think this is going to wind up being a legislative priority. I don't think with everything else going on in the world right now that this is, but I don't know. I mean, it's one of those mixed feelings things. I don't want to vote against it. You know what I'm saying? I don't want to talk down about it. But then again, but this kind of bill comes up every single year. We will mandate that everyone will have a moment of reflective silence in school. Okay. We will mandate that everyone will do the Pledge of Allegiance in school. I love the Pledge of Allegiance. Are we going to run a bill to say that, really? I don't know. It's one of those things where I look at it and go, I don't know. But there it is. And it comes up. It's the same old legislative story. Those things come up every year. Some are good. Some are like, that's kind of hokey. Some are being done so you could say you did. And then there's people like Representative Wandling Gavant. I'm just going to be honest with you. Wandling Gavant's an activist. There's no way around it. That woman is an activist legislator. Her entire intent is on being inflammatory and seeing what she can get done that gets her another opportunity for a soundbite on the news. She is also, if I'm not mistaken, running for Congress in Congressional District 2, even though she doesn't actually live in the district. But that being said, she's notorious for what I would call bad bills. Like this one. She has now filed what's called HB 5, House Bill 5. It's the Ebony Alert System. Oh, it's just exactly what you think it is. The Ebony Alert System would send out alerts to all of us, all of our cell phones, and put it on TV and radio and everything else, only when there's a missing black youth or black woman. Why? Why? Well, it's important, she says. It's important because, you know, we got more people of color that are going missing than we have anybody else, so we need an Ebony Alert System. You know what? That's the most jackleg thing I've ever heard. So it's only going to be a special alert if the young woman who's missing is black? So I guess Asians, Hispanics, and Caucasians have just, you know, good luck. But Wandling Gavant, notorious. By the way, she's not done yet. How about this one? She has one that I just don't know you can actually do. I believe she has a law degree, I think. So I would hope she would know stuff like, you know, what it means to develop what's called a protected class. But she's got one called House Bill 18, which deals with body weight and size discrimination. Yeah, it's exactly what you think it is. This bill would make it illegal to deny an individual the full and equal enjoyment of their public accommodations like restaurants and movie theaters due to their weight. Who does that? I don't think anybody says, excuse me, ma'am, I'm sorry, you appear to be too large for our restaurant. I mean, if somebody is very large, they tend to self-discriminate because they might say, I'm not going down there because I don't think it's comfortable. I don't like their booths or whatever, you know. But no, Wandling Gavant, she wants to make it an employment discrimination issue also if for any reason someone feels like they can prove that their weight is the reason why they didn't get a job or lost a job. So body weight and size discrimination would be a new protected class under state law if Wandling Gavant has her way. What you got? I see it's on you. It's on you right now. You can't hardly
stand
it.
So how about your, let's just say, law enforcement, military requirements for entry? Is that gonna be in conflict?
I don't think so, because under the law they have what's called BFOQs, bona fide occupational qualifications. If you're a fireman, you have to be able to, the standard is like carry, you know, a 150 pound person out of a burning building, or carry the coiled up hoses up the ladder, you know, all that kind of stuff. So they're gonna still be allowed to have BFOQs, you're still gonna see stuff. You're gonna have restaurants getting sued because their booth was too small. That's what you're gonna have. You're gonna have movie theaters who are being sued because you could not raise up the armrest in the middle to make a seat bigger. You're gonna have bus companies or taxis or Uber services being sued because they showed up and it was too tight of space and I felt discriminated against. That's what you're gonna have.
So when do we get the overweight alert system?
Oh yeah, the ebony, how about the ebony overweight alert system? Can we have that?
That's too discriminatory.
That's just, I mean, if, as long as we're going to focus in, we only want, you know, overweight black people to have an ebony alert, overweight alert system. I don't know. It's you know, but this same old legislative story, this kind of crap happens every single year. Stuff comes up and you look at it and go, do you not understand the law? Allegedly, you have a law degree, don't you? And then you have this one. Watch out for changes to try and, you know, make things easier for Democrats to cheat on elections, right? Kenyatta Hassel, who is a Democrat in the state House, has a bill pre-filed right now, House Bill 23. And the whole intent of this one is to make it easier to do absentee ballots without having to give any reason for why you're doing an absentee ballot. Because right now, what you're required to do is have your, you know, your photo ID, and you have to check the block as to why you needed an absentee ballot, which is an attestation on your part that I would not be available. I'm going to be out of the country. You know, I'm caring for an elderly family member. Who knows? Whatever the reason. But nope, they say this bill would change the procedures by not including any reasons for voting absentee on the affidavit. It would just be because you felt like it. I just want to go ahead and vote now. I want to do early voting, and I want it all now.
Are they still going to require ID?
Well, her bill didn't deal with ID, but I guarantee you they're fighting back on that too. Watch for the other bills.
It's the most insane.
It is. It is. I mean, why? Why would you do that? Well, we just want to make it easier. Okay. Why do you want to make it so much easier?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I'm all about get out there and vote, but yeah, at some point, perhaps we should make it harder so that the quality of the vote shows an actual effort.
Yeah. And oh, by the way, ballot access and voter integrity can be synonymous. You can have them work hand in hand. It's not like you're saying, well, ballot access, you can't have your voter integrity if you're going to have real ballot access. Yeah, actually you can. A photo ID is not hard. You have to have a photo ID to shop at Costco. I mean, just, you know, saying. If you want to buy alcohol, you got to have a photo ID. If you want to get on a plane, you got to have a photo ID.
Seems pretty simple.
Just seems pretty simple. How about this one? Y'all, in the time I have before the break here, I will just tell you that one of the things you're going to see and hear every single year, and here's how you smell it out. Okay. Let's say you're hunting, right? And you're let's say you're stalking deer. There are sounds, there are sights. There's signs you can find, like, you know, hoof prints or deer scat. You know, you can begin to sort of determine whether or not something is in the area, right? Do the same thing with legislation. You begin to smell it. You can see the traces. You find the little nuggets they're dropping here and there to sort of begin baiting the hook. Well, that's what we got with Medicaid expansion. I guarantee you. Not the least of which is the Alabama County, the Association of County Commissions. I dealt with them a lot. I got several awards from them. They're sitting on my shelf downstairs right now. But the Association of County Commissions and I had a good relationship, and I will tell you right now, what I smell is Medicaid expansion coming out of them right now. So they just had their annual meeting just about 2 weeks ago down in Auburn. All the county commissions around the state gather up together and talk about all their goodness and what they're going to do and how they're going to accomplish great things and what the latest laws and trends are and what their legislative agenda will be. And right now, they are saying their legislative agenda is to increase access to mental health response and mental health crisis centers. And I get it. That's good stuff. But when they say that their goal then is to also increase up to 3,200 additional beds for those going through mental health crises in mental health centers, there's no way to just put that on the private sector. You have to increase the coverage to make that kind of thing available so the private sector will then add more rooms to their facilities. Or you have a state-run facility. The only way you can mandate that is to say, A, you increase certain things that private insurance has to cover, which has happened before, like autism. Or you say, we're going to do Medicaid expansion so all y'all can qualify, everybody. What does Medicaid expansion mean? Medicaid expansion means Right now, certain people qualify for Medicaid based upon their income or whatever else. We're just going to raise that threshold, or actually lower that threshold. We're going to lower that threshold. Now more people qualify. Do you know like 25% of Alabama, 25% of our 5 million residents is on some form of Medicaid? We're one of the highest Medicaid participation states in the nation, if I'm not mistaken. But we're also one of only 10 that has refused to go with the Obamacare Medicaid expansions. Why? Because, yes, the federal government gives you some money for it at first, and then they wean themselves off of it, and guess how much it's going to cost you? Hundreds of millions of dollars to the state to maintain it. And once you give somebody something, don't try and take it away later. If you say you're going to do it, you're stuck with it for life. All right, listen, we're going to take a break right now. We'll come right back and cover a few more of these same old legislative stories. And I mean, there's a few more. And then coming up top of the hour, Stephanie Smith calling in, talking about their latest report on gambling and what she's hearing. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio, solid conservative and just plain right. We'll be right back. We are back. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Solid conservative and just plain right. Just, I mean, like, wow, making common sense like a superpower. Hey, listen, so right before the break, I told you when it comes to things like Medicaid expansion and other big stuff they know is going to be controversial, like I said, you begin to see the signs. You can smell it. You can sort of see the bits and pieces. So one of them is right now, in my opinion, I'm looking at this and sort of gathering up my intel, right? I'm doing an all-source intel analysis on what I'm seeing with Medicaid expansion. County commissions, the only way they can say they're going to be pushing for expansion of mental health, care and expansion of mental health available beds, in my opinion, is going to be Medicaid expansion. And then I see an article on APR, Alabama Public Radio. Why do we care? Well, they're still a voice. APR ran a piece that came out just about 45 days ago. And it says, and here you go, classic argument. This, I guarantee you, was pretty much written by the Hospital Association. New report says Medicaid expansion would help Alabama workforce and the economy. Great. If we just had more Medicaid, we'd have more jobs, and we'd have, I mean... Okay, so according to Community Catalyst, what is Community Catalyst? I don't even know what Community Catalyst is. A nonprofit group called Community Catalyst did a report where they estimate that 20,000 new jobs per year would be added if we would just expand Medicaid in Alabama. 20,000 new jobs? Wow. And $11.36 billion over the next 6 years. By the way, how many of those new jobs are government sector jobs because they got to run the Medicaid organization? And how many of those, oh, by the way, are the Hospital Association begging for it because they want one more way to bill people? More billable people means more reimbursement for the hospital. That'll just make it better for us. Well, so the new report shows that expanding Medicaid would lead to a boost in the economy. I have heard this mantra. You talk about the same old legislative story. They've been saying this for, it'll be good for the economy. No, it won't. You're increasing entitlements. And oh, by the way, who pays for Medicaid? Who? Let's ask the question and let's be honest. Stop with the disingenuous, it's just good for everybody. Is it? Who pays for Medicaid? The answer is we do. No, Phil, federal government does. Who pays for the federal government? The answer is we do. Well, but they're going to send down federal matching dollars. Yeah. Oh, so you're saying, oh, I get it. So I say, okay, so if we put more state tax dollars into Medicaid, then we can draw down more federal matching dollars. Oh, that's awesome. It's like free money. No, it's not. We pay for both of it. All you're doing is saying, hey, and guess what? Right now, Medicaid by itself consumes like 40% of the general fund budget in the state of Alabama. Without expanding, 40%. We are chunking money into it. Don't think for a second that we don't, well, this is a heartless argument that you've got, Phil, and you need to expand your own capabilities to and have a heart of compassion. I voted for Medicaid. I voted for Medicaid to receive funding every single year I was in Montgomery. And I also voted not to expand it. And that's just, you know, listen, but you can smell it coming. I'm telling you, the same old legislative story. Democrats are already calling for it. The question is, right now, are we going to see Republicans crawl on board and sort of throw that out there as a bone? Hey, Democrats, if you'll vote for that gambling bill, we'll let you take up Medicaid expansion. Yeah, how's that?
So I looked up Community Catalyst.
Yeah, what you got?
Their website, homepage, United for Health Justice, building the power of people to create a health system rooted in race equity and health justice and a society where health is a right for all.
Well, now we know why APR ran their report. But I'm going to tell you right now, man, that's but see, race justice and not race justice, but healthcare justice. We got environmental justice. We got healthcare justice. How about this? At some point, you can't keep going back to the trough. You know what? Either that or to tax us more. Hey, there's an idea. Just tax us more. It'll be awesome. Then we can do everything. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Coming up next, we'll hear from Stephanie Smith. Y'all stand by. You Right Side ruffians out there, you are listening to Right Side Radio, solid conservative, just plain right.
You're listening live to Right Side Radio with Phil Williams. It's hard to go wrong when you're on the right side. Right Side Radio, solid conservative, and just plain right.
Alabama's syndicated news talk leader, Right Side Radio, Phil Williams, here live in the Right Side studios. Man, we got the local, the state, the national, covering down on all the issues. And yeah, like the dude just said, solid conservative and just plain right. Well, welcome to hour number two on this Friday. And on the phone right now, friend of this show, friend of me, Stephanie Smith, president of the Alabama Policy Institute. Stephanie Smith, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Fry-yay is, it's always like home fries or fry-yay. I think it's fun to be here on Friday. So thank you for always inviting me on Friday when it's,
yes,
you know, it's fun,
like,
zone.
It's like, whoo, anything you say is okay because it's fry-yay. That's all right.
hey, I hope that's true.
Yeah. Well, I hope it is too, but we'll see what you have to say. But you guys just came out with a major study we'll get to here in a minute. I think you said you heard I called it my diatribe about Medicaid expansion,
right,
a moment ago. I don't know if you agree with it fully. Tell me your thoughts on it. You've worked in state government. You worked for Governor Riley, as a matter of fact. What Medicaid expansion has been talked about every year since Methuselah was a child. What are you thinking?
Right. Yeah, it's one of those, the framing of it from the people who want to expand it is that we're the holdout. You know, so where there are only 10 states who haven't expanded it, what are we waiting for, that kind of thing. The way I describe Medicaid expansion to people who aren't involved in healthcare, including me, is it's basically like taking out a mortgage on your house with a banker that doesn't like you. And the banker that doesn't like you offers you a balloon loan, but doesn't tell you what it's going to balloon to. You just got to trust them. And so you really want to, you like this house. And so you take the mortgage out, and you're just rolling the dice to see how much you're going to owe him later. But this banker doesn't even like you, so it's a really bad decision to make.
That's Okay, if I don't mind, I'm just going to steal that description and use it myself later, because that's...
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just one of those, it's like, this makes no sense. No one in real life would sign that document.
Yeah.
They would not do that with their own money. They would not do that with their own family, so we shouldn't do it as a state.
Well, and people don't realize, too, that, I mean, if I recall, the Medicaid expansion provisions of the Affordable Care Act, so-called Affordable mm-hmm. Care Act, say that the federal government will up their match for the state for the first 3 years. But after three
right.
years, man, you're already on. Yeah, they baited you in, got you used to it. Now you got to keep
right.
it, and then you're on the hook.
Well, and you've offered it to your people, right? You've set criteria. You created an entitlement program, and then you are the, have to be the one to take it away, which you and I know is never going to happen.
Yep.
So then you're just on the hook for some sort another unfunded liability for the state, and it's frankly uninventive. There are other ways to get at the mental health crisis. There are other ways to expand rural health care. There are studies that say that an expansion of Medicaid actually doesn't help with either one of those things because it's just an increase on people who are already getting free care. It's pay, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul.
Now, Stephanie,
I can smell it in the air.
Yeah, well, you can. It's not a good odor. But they say it'll bring 20,000 jobs, Stephanie, 20,000 jobs.
Yeah, it's, you know... It's easy to find somebody to say what you want them to say. I'll just say that.
Yeah. Yeah, there was no agenda in that particular report. Well, all right. So before we get into your big new white paper, which came out yesterday on gambling, let me ask you this. School choice, I just saw something a minute ago. One of the school choice advocates here in the state said, things are looking really good for ESAs, education savings accounts, for this coming session. That the Senate should pass it without any trouble. The House will be where it may slow down, and it really depends upon the governor's ability to get behind it. So what are you thinking? What are you hearing on school choice?
Yeah, I mean, school choice and that legislation and the coalition around it, national coalition, statewide coalition, has been honestly what I've probably spent the most amount of time on policy-wise since I've been at API this year. And we've been working on it. It is looking better than it has, for sure. It's a proof in the pudding kind of situation. It depends on what Governor Ivey comes out with. It depends on, frankly, the budget chairs and their amount of enthusiasm for spending the surplus or the corpus on this function of government. And it also depends on exactly how it is structured, because it's a loose coalition of folks who want school choice, but there are a lot of people who feel very strongly that true school choice cannot go through the Department of Education or be beholden to the Board of Education, because the people who want to opt out of the system don't want to be controlled by the system. And so it'll be interesting to see what Governor Ivey comes out with. I am encouraged by my conversations with those in her office, and I'm frankly encouraged with the conversations I've had with legislators. I think that the national movement of school choice might just bring Alabama along to a real ESA school choice program this year or next.
Well, it would be obviously long overdue, and it would also, you know, you look at some of the things that it takes years to get done, and there have been some very good pieces of legislation that couldn't happen in the first year. They took years of massaging, years of effort.
Mm-hmm.
I look at pro-life legislation. For years, it was sort of an affiliated group of pro-life advocates that kept bringing mm-hmm. back bills and bringing back pieces and getting it done incrementally. But, you know, here we are now, and Roe was overturned, and yay.
Absolutely.
Well, listen, so you guys, people don't realize if they want to do a deep dive on an issue, if they're looking at it saying, look, I'm a conservative, I want to know what, you know, I want to know beyond just the sound bites and the headlines, how I should form my thoughts and what I can do to arm myself for the discussions. You guys provide some amazing research. I used to use it as a legislator myself, API's materials.
Mm-hmm.
But y'all just came out with a pretty extensive review on the state of gambling in the state of Alabama. And give me some of the highlights of this. What are you seeing, and what does the report give folks if they want a copy of it?
Yeah, so gambling has been talked about ad nauseum. You and I, I'm sure, both call it the zombie legislation. Right. It's always back. It's always some new iteration of the same discussion. So you would think that there wouldn't be anything new to write a report or a study about gambling in the state of Alabama or otherwise. But the truth is this. The conversation has changed about gambling because technology has changed. And so when, in the old Siegelman days, Siegelman gambling and lottery fight, we were really talking about, what you would see on TV, like, somebody's grandma stopping for a scratch-off ticket on the way to Florida every spring break or whatever. That is not what gambling or even the lottery is anymore. The gambling situation is heavily digital now, whether or not you're talking about sports betting or lottery or instant games. And so as I started to really dig into the changes in gambling, I realized that even I didn't understand the full scope of the changes and how that changes the level of addiction, how that changes how what types of people are being targeted for the different types of gambling. And so we're not just talking about, a casino tucked away somewhere in Greene County and a scratch-off ticket, for fun, or, a pool of people in an office, trying to get the Mega Millions or something. It's not 1980. It's not even 1990. And so gambling has shifted. And so I wanted to put out a report, just investigating that, how it has changed, how the gambling industry has changed. And I just wanted people to be able to read through and understand exactly what it means to say you're pro-lottery, exactly what it means to say you're good with changing our Constitution to allow games of chance in the state of Alabama, because it's not as simple as you would think.
No, it's not. And you just labeled something, too, the fact that it is a constitutional provision. This is not a matter of statutory law. The legislature can't just do it on their own. There are aspects of what we're talking about that will have to also come before the people for a vote, because a constitutional provision does require a referendum. And it also requires a higher threshold of vote on the floor of the House and Senate. So it's going to be interesting. It's an uphill climb. What are you hearing with about a minute and a half left here? What are you hearing still? I mean, every time I I know you have your ear to the ground on this, but every time we talk, I ask what you're hearing, because I know you're in touch with a lot of folks. Is it going to pass? Is the House more got a better appetite for it than the Senate does? What are you thinking?
I think the House leadership is more on board than the Senate leadership. I think that in general, some of our newest House members feel very uncomfortable with the expansion of gambling because it's an expansion of government. And then I think there are a lot of people who, once you talk to them about what it might actually look like, depending on the definitions, they're uncomfortable with putting gambling in the pocket of every person who has a smartphone, because you can't be genuinely saying that you're curtailing gambling or creating a new enforcement of gambling when you're handing it to 1.5 million people, including teenage boys.
Yeah, yeah. And teenage girls, thank you very much.
Well, I will tell you this. My teenage girls, I would also be worried about. And I ran stats for Auburn University when I was there. So I would definitely be in the category of teenage girls who would be susceptible to this as well.
Well, it's okay. So thank you, by the way, for your work once again. It's a far bigger thing than just, like you said, just I want a lottery ticket. I just want to scratch up. Well, you know what? There's nobody within a stone's throw of either border where you can get a ticket. But the truth is, it's not as easy as that, and it's also got a whole lot more history than that. And the fact that we don't have it now is a clear indication that that and casino gaming, is a clear indication that there have been problems along the way that have never fully been rectified, and they may have even increased since then. Stephanie Smith, thanks so much for your work. If they want to know more about you, where can they find out?
You can find all about us at alabamapolicy.org, and we put all of our information out for the public so that everybody can see exactly what we're talking about and then make their decisions for themselves.
Great. To include that report we just talked about, right?
Absolutely. It's already out there.
All right. Thanks, Stephanie. Have a great day. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Phil.
All right. We're taking a break. We'll take the break right now. I'll put a lid on this one. And yeah, then we're going to move into number two, Triple Dipper, DEI-OMG. We'll talk about it. Phil Williams, Right Side Radio. Y'all stay tuned. We'll be right back.